Do you love freedom? Do you love being clean? Then you'll love Hero Soap Company, made in the USA. Chemical and fragrance free. A portion of each purchase donated to veteran and first responder charities. Initial subscription purchase is matched bar for bar and sent overseas to deploy troops. Let freedom clean. Hero Soap Company.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Adam Stokes. Before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Go check us out on Rockfin. This is where you get our premium content, regular shows, and best of all the amazing content from every creator on Rockfin. Check out the podcasts that we feature on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. You can get them all on our website. That's forbiddenknowledge.news, or click the link in the description. Follow us on Facebook. Those links are also in the description. You can follow us there to get announcements and updates. And check out C60 Purple Power, maybe the most powerful antioxidant known to man. The benefits have been amazing. Check out the website for yourself. Click the link in the description. If you order there, you get 10% off plus free shipping. Tonight, I want to welcome back to the show Professor Adam Stokes. He has degrees in religion from Duke University and Yale Divinity School. He is the author of From Egypt to Ohio, A Semitic Origin for the Giants of North America, The Latin Scrolls, Selections from the Five Megaloth Translated from the Latin Vulgate. His work has been featured in various magazines and podcasts, and he currently teaches high school Latin and a college course on the Old Testament. Adam, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Good to be back.
It's great to have you back. Today, we're going to be talking about, again, some of my favorite stuff related to our real hidden history, which is really so much more extraordinary than we've ever been taught, what's in our history books, and what mainstream science would essentially have us to believe. I felt from a very young age that there were so many aspects of our history that didn't fit, and I'm really grateful for researchers like yourself that are bringing this information to light and bringing this to people's consciousness, because I think that it's very important that we've reached a critical time in our history where we're learning as a species that a lot of the stuff we've been told and learned throughout our lives isn't really the way it occurred. So it's really great that you're doing this kind of work. I'd love for you to remind the audience, again, since it's been a little while since you've been on, what brought you down the path that you're on?
Well, basically just my own interest in ancient American history. I start off from my religious views. I'm part of a Latter-day Saint tradition. And for all Latter-day Saints, commonly called Mormons, we believe in something called the Book of Mormon as an ancient record of a civilization that once existed here in either North America or South America. That's kind of debated. But that ancient America had a very sophisticated and high-tech civilization at one time. And so my own personal religious beliefs was kind of the impetus for me researching and seeing if this claim that is in our sacred text is true. And really, through my research, uncovering a lot of things that show that ancient Native American culture here was highly advanced, just as advanced as any ancient empire, Rome, Greece, et cetera, and much more advanced than your typical American history textbook has given it credit for.
Yeah, 100%. Now, when we're looking at the age of modern Homo sapiens sapiens and modern man, that can, you know, that was intelligent, had knowledge of the stars, agriculture, mathematics, could build with tools. Based on your research, how far back does this version of man, how far back does this version of man go?
Great question. I think this version of man has always been around. I don't think it's as recent as evolutionary biologists would say. I'm not an evolutionary biologist myself, but I know from the archaeological record, we have Homo sapiens. Michael Cremo talks about this in his book, Forbidden Archaeology. We have Homo sapiens who were here millions of years ago. The same bone type, the same DNA structure was here millions of years ago. Now we have other species that are introduced. They come into the lineage over time. So Denisovans, Cro-Magnon man, but I think human beings as you and I are now always existed. And I think that the type of Homo sapien that existed in the past was a much more advanced and stronger and mightier individual than what we have now. We like to think of ourselves as the pinnacle of civilization, that we are the best type of human that has ever existed. But I don't think that's true. I think we're actually in a decline based on what you read in earlier traditions and earlier sources. Homer, for example, in the Odyssey talks about human beings before his time in the age, in the golden age of the Greek heroes, Achilles, Odysseus, and et cetera, as being of greater strength and of a greater type of human than the people in his own time.
And I'm sure the technology that we were looking at for those ancient civilizations, we wouldn't be looking for the same type of technology we're using today, you know, with machinery and wires and technology and things of that nature. It'd be a different type. It'd probably be a more efficient type, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, Chris, because a certain civilization such as the Greeks did have a type of computer similar to, you know, what we have now. So they weren't completely without the technology. For the Romans, for example, they had a steam engine, but they didn't use it for their cars. They preferred to use slaves carrying litters around with people in them. But they did have a steam engine that they had created and knew how to use. So they had some of the stuff we had. But like you said, a lot of their technology was different than ours. I think it was a cleaner technology. I think a lot of it was using sonar, sound, and also using psychic abilities. So the Atlanteans, for example, that many researchers talk about, their society likely consists, if you read of Edgar Cayce and my friend Dr. Greg Little, they'll talk about, you know, Atlantis possibly having flying cars based on the descriptions that we get in ancient sources. But not flying around with, you know, gasoline and jet fuel like we have now, but through the power of sound and even perhaps through psychic power. So it was a much different technology. And I think ultimately, you know, our smartphone is cool. We can just touch buttons and it's like really fancy and kind of Star Trek like. But I think their technology was cleaner than our technology now.
Right. And you've done a lot of research into the natives of the Americas, you know, in North America mainly, and their how advanced they were. And not many, you don't hear this at all in any history books, or you don't hear it at all, that Native Americans were any type of advanced civilization. But to bring that possibility to table is not that far-fetched based on the difference in history that we're starting to learn now, right? So how do you think, how advanced do you think the natives were?
Well, we can clearly see, especially in the Southwest and in some of the canyon regions that they've excavated, we have evidence of basically big metropolis cities, still like very similar to what we have today with, you know, New York, Paris, and the like. And a lot of ancient records for myself, a person of faith taking the Book of Mormon as a historical document, talks about massive metropolises that were all over. But not just that, the ancient Americans' own native histories talk about these massive cities all across the country. And it's funny, well, it's not so funny, it's actually very sad. When the European settlers came and spread smallpox, they traveled through the continent And there were swarms of Native Americans who had died because of the smallpox, but they found cities and areas all around them. And in some cases, the smallpox hit so fast that there were some Native American groups that even forgot about, you know, where some of these cities were and, you know, what was their function, what was their purpose. But they retained a little bit, some memory of them, some kind of past memory of them, even though the European colonization, the Europeans who came, had devastated them through the smallpox and through other things. But in their own traditions is retained memory of these great cities that once existed. And we see this with the mounds. We look at the mounds now and they just look like clumps of dirt. But, you know, 1500 years ago, these were kind of the epicenters of many of the cities, many of the ancient Native American cities throughout North America.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the mounds because that's what I wanted to bring up next. First of all, you know, the way they name these mounds, Mound A, Mound B, it's like they don't want to draw any attention to what these things are. You know, they're such simplifications when it comes to the explanations of what they are and the names, just like I mentioned.
In the very name is kind of, you know, an idea that, you know, we don't want to really, you know, go deeper into these things. I think that's the way that American anthropology, American archaeology has looked at these things for the past 150 years.
Definitely. Now, based on your research, these mounds are remains of more advanced city structures or something else?
I think there's a lot going on with the mounds. So they are remains of advanced cities. So just like with the Egyptian pyramids, we look at the pyramids now, but that wasn't all that existed. If you went back into ancient Egypt, there have been whole buildings and towns and fortifications all around those pyramids. And they would have looked much different than they do now. The same with the mounds here in North America. So these were kind of epicenters, and then around the mounds were buildings and fortifications, basically small towns, and even to a great scale for some of these mounds. For some of these mound regions, cities. So they will look much different than they currently exist now. So the mounds that we have, there's been a lot of kind of intrusion into them, deforestation, destruction of the property around them, both deliberate and accidental. So we don't get the full picture coming to it as modern 21st century researchers.
Approximately when do you think the last of the truly, really advanced Native American civilizations died out?
Yeah, I would say, so the mound builders, even before the European settlement, Native American culture had some memory of these great mound builders. I and other researchers have said, you know, these were giants, by the time the European settlers came, even that memory of the mound builders was old. So we know that there was some type of great battle. For some reason, the mound building civilization stops at around the 5th century CE, 6th century CE, for whatever reason. Like I said, there's evidence, there's possible evidence of warfare, but we're not quite sure why. What happens after that is that even though this mound building civilization goes away, called the Hopewell, called the Adena, which aren't their actual names, as I mentioned before, I think, Native Americans who are left behind kind of pick up on these civilizations. So they kind of take over these mounds where these mound builders once existed. And they also build mounds for themselves. So not all mounds are the same. A lot of mounds are imitations of the great mounds that were erected by the Hopewell and the Adena, or the giants of the Great Lakes, as I like to call them.
Now let's get into some of the major differences among these early ancient, you know, probably pre-flood ancient civilization natives. Now you mentioned giants. Do you think that they were just a larger group, a larger civilization, or were they kind of mixed with normal size humans?
That's a great question, Chris. I think that their origin. I would say even perhaps Atlantis, but some civilization that goes so far back, we can't classify them. But over the course of time, they did start to intermingle with, I guess you would say, normal sized humans. So we get a lot of this in the Old Testament, beginning with Genesis 6 and all throughout Israel's history. These giants seem to interact and a lot of times intermingle with the Israelites, but not just in the Near East. I think there is a giant mixing in Europe, as you see in the tales of giants in German and Irish folklore, and in the New World with the Native American peoples. And I think that a lot of not only the culture of the giants, but even the DNA of the giants is retained in a lot of Native American culture. So Native Americans, I've mentioned this before, some of the tallest people that you have in the world are not from Africa, as you would expect, but Native Americans here in North America.
Now, when we're talking about these giants, based on all the evidence that we have, physical evidence, hidden evidence, written evidence, how tall are we talking?
At least the smallest giant, at least 7 feet. There are reports that go up to around 12 feet, and then at least in North America. And then if you get to kind of the biblical giants or giants of the old world, both Europe and the Near East, there's some ridiculous accounts, you know, 20, 30 foot giants. And again, not all giants are necessarily the same. You have different species of giant, but they all are similar in that they interact with your normal sized human beings, and they have a propensity, as I've mentioned earlier, for kind of they have a propensity for violence and bloodshed. And this is seen throughout their history.
Yeah, these giants seem to definitely get a bad rap when it comes to violence. But were they all of this, you know, violent nature, or was it kind of a more dualistic society where some were malevolent and some were benevolent? What do you think?
That's a good point. I think, you know, going back to the origin of the giants, where did some of these giant groups come from? If you examine, for example, Atlantis, you know, there seems to have been a race of people possibly connected to the giants who, if you read Plato and stuff, were fairly benevolent. They used whatever abilities that they had for good. But, you know, as is the case oftentimes in history, even now in the 21st century, the guys who try to use their stuff for good kind of get overrun by the people who are jerks, who are bad. So, I definitely think that there's kind of this inter-giant strife between, you know, the more violent giants and the giants who are more benevolent. But the giants who are more violent tend to win out.
Do you think that it was just the case that everything on the planet was bigger during these ancient times? You know, the wildlife, plant life, animals, and of course, humans.
I definitely think so. So I was on another podcast where they mentioned this. So in North America, there are places where you have these rocks that look very much like animal figures.
Right. Yes. And I have some of those in Colorado here. We were looking at those the other day.
Yep. Yep. And the trees are in trees that are enormous. I mean, you see Yosemite Park, you know, those trees look like freaking skyscrapers. So, you know, I think that kind of everything, and this goes back to this idea that we really haven't progressed as both human beings as basically species on Earth in general, that we've kind of de-evolved from what we were. I think everything was a lot bigger back in the day, including not just human beings and not just these giants, but animals and just nature itself. And over the course of time, things have dwindled down to what they are now.
Based on your research, what is the most compelling evidence for these giants, whether it's physical evidence or, you know, written documented evidence? First, let's start with physical, of course.
Yeah, I think physical evidence is just the skeletal remains. Now, people say, you know, whenever you mention giants, people say, where are the skeletal remains? I think, you know, there are some very good explanations for, you know, where those skeletal remains went to. We have dozens of documented pictures and photographs, more than dozens, you know, hundreds of documented pictures and photographs. Mainstream archaeology will say that, you know, these pictures are doctored. Show me all of these bones. But this is where mainstream archaeology is also very hypocritical, because there are a lot of people in history that archaeology takes for granted. We don't have the bones of them, but they assume from, you know, written records, from oral accounts of them, from written accounts of them, these people existed. So why make that assumption there and not make it for the giants, where we have photographic evidence for these remains? And I should add that even in some private museums, we do have giant bones. Where are the rest of the giant bones? There's a lot of explanations for that. The Smithsonian taking bones out of a bog area, which you would have in the mounds, would deteriorate the bones. But I think that the pictorial evidence, the documented evidence for giants, is excellent, and there is no debate about it. Now, people will just, mainstream archaeologists will draw on the three or four famous examples of hoaxes, but if you look at, you know, all the new newspaper clippings, newspaper articles that were collected, not just by, you know, your average town newspaper, but by scientific journals, even the Smithsonian itself at times, I think that's excellent evidence for these giants having existed as physical evidence. I also think that the Native American traditions are very strong evidence in favor of these giants existing.
Now, and until how recent do you think these giants were alive? How long ago do you think there was the last standing giant?
Yeah, I think that, you know, around 500 CE, 400, 500 CE, these giants start to die off. So we know for the Hopewell and Adena, especially for the Hopewell, their empire just disappear by 500 CE. They no longer exist. So I would say that is a time when the last official giant died off. But remember, they're intermingling with the Native American population. So I think that their bloodline continues amongst the Native Americans of today. And I also think that, you know, as with anything, you're not going to kill everybody off. So I think that a remnant of the giants may have gone into hiding in places in North America that are kind of difficult to get to, the Grand Canyon, under the earth.
I was just about to ask you that.
The hidden world, as we call it. And I think a lot of the sightings that you get of Bigfoot, for example, and there have been researchers who have spent large amounts of time researching this, may be a remnant of that giant race. So Bigfoot's always described, he's at least 7 feet, if not higher, if not taller. So I think that may be a remnant of this mound builder giant civilization.
And, you know, the Bigfoot thing, that would totally make a lot of sense as to, you know, if these giants went into some kind of exile into wilderness, of course they'd grow more hair and then probably look different over time. So that's a great explanation there. That's very interesting. Now, when it comes to the features of these giants, you know, you have reports of a lot of them with red hair and mm-hmm. six fingers.
The CK Tarians, yep. I mean, yeah. CK Taj giant, yep.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about, you know, what are those common features? And were there, you know, different types of giants, or was it mainly these six-fingered, red-haired looking things?
Yeah, you get this in the Old Testament as well. So you have Goliath, who is a normal, who seems to be appearance-wise look like your normal human being. He's just taller than everybody else. And then you have other giants in the Bible who are described as having six fingers and six toes. So there's an Egyptian giant who's mentioned in the Bible as having six fingers and six toes, who's an enemy of Israel. and some warrior dude in Israel takes him down. Same with the, and we see this all over the world. So you have these different types of giants who are migrating all over the world, but there's these subspecies within them. So some of the giants look normal. They look just like us. They're just taller. Other giants have elongated skulls. We see that a lot. And going back to the physical evidence, there are private museums in Peru, for example, that have those elongated skulls. I've seen, you can find pictures of them on the internet. So you have that. Then you have red-haired giants, who I think there's an old world connection there, possibly with the giants of Ireland, possibly. And then you have giants with these kind of fang-like teeth. So you have different species of giants. We know this already. We know this from a scientific perspective with the Denisovans. The Denisovans were giants. Andrew Collins and Greg Little talk about this. They were a giant species, but they looked physically distinct from, they had features that were distinct from your Homo sapiens. So, yeah, so a variety of different giants, but all of them seem to be kind of a traveling community, crossing continents, traveling all over, and establishing kind of their culture, their dominance over the indigenous people of the land.
And I believe we touched on this last time, but many of them were also cannibalistic, right?
Yeah, like the CK Taw Indians, they were giants were cannibalistic. And that's what made the Native Americans rise up against them and eventually drive them out. Kind of this, the giants with their propensity for violence, kind of self-inflicted themselves, brought about their own destruction through their violence. So, and this is a common theme. I mean, read Jack, for example, Jack and the Beanstalk. The giants in their cruelty, people eventually get tired of this, they get sick of this, and so they overthrow and defeat the giant.
Now, and this was most likely a global phenomenon. These giants existed,
yes, absolutely,
over the whole planet. Do you,
yeah,
think that there is any connection there to also the elongated skulls that they find around the planet?
Yes, yes. So I think the elongated skulls come from a particular giant species. I think those elongated skulls reflect increased psychic ability because they have a bigger brain. And I think that this how all, especially in the old world, and even in parts of the new world, in Canada and stuff, for example, these hedges, such as Stonehenge and stuff, I think that the rocks and boulders are moved by these giants using their psychic ability.
That goes right into the megalithic construction that I wanted to talk about. You mentioned psychic abilities, these individuals could have had much more advanced abilities and strength. And I would imagine it's probably easier if you're just plain old lifting heavy stones as a giant, and if there's a bunch of you to do it, it would make construction a lot easier. But add the ability of some kind of psychic mental abilities, that make it 1,000 times easier, right?
Yeah. I think for some things, the giants were, I like to say, lazy. They never did anything hard themselves. So we know that in North America, at least, a lot of the construction of the mounds was likely done by the normal-sized human beings who were subservient to them. So the giants were the kings and queens, and they had basically us Homo sapiens just doing stuff for them. So when it came to the hard work, they weren't pushing this stuff around themselves. They either had somebody else do it, or in the case of the old world, where we get with like Stonehenge and stuff, they're using their mind, they're using their psychic ability. They're not pushing this stuff by themselves. And I think it's clear, as any anthropologist or archaeologist would tell you, it's clear that nobody could have pushed these boulders by themselves.
Right. And that would make sense as to, the distances that the stones were able to move. What do you think about some of the actual construction processes, like cutting of the stones and being able to form rock into certain shapes and things of that nature.
Yeah. I think, you know, again, I think that ancient civilization was much more highly advanced than we give it credit for. And we have things, so for example, at Göbekli Tepe, we have things that were cut in a way that it would be difficult, you know, even with the laser cutter now, for us to do. So whatever technology they had, maybe they had something like an atomic, you know, ray or something like that, whatever technology they had was even more advanced than what we have now. You know, is it a technology of, you know, the mind of psychic ability, or is this something that they create something that could cut the stones, cut the slabs in this way? I'm not sure. But nonetheless, the giant civilization, it was highly advanced, very high tech. That wasn't the problem with it. Its problem was its propensity for violence, which kind of brought everything, you know, crashing down. So whatever technology that they had got lost when their civilization was destroyed.
Now, do you think that there could be some kind of maybe supernatural or metaphysical link to this? When you look at the Book of Enoch, you know, they call these Nephilim of fallen angels, you know, the Nephilim are the offspring of these fallen angels, these celestial entities that mated with women. Do you think there could be anything to these stories from Enoch?
Yeah, I've always taken the term Nephilim as referring, so it's a participle, masculine plural participle, meaning the fallen ones. And I always took that to refer to a particular one of the giant civilizations that had just fallen over the course of time. So as we talk about the fall of the Roman Empire or the fall of the Confederacy, that's how I've always taken it. But there are other scholars, Van Doniken, Stichen, who would give a supernatural or extraterrestrial explanation for the giants. It's interesting, though, because I think that the giants were very much connected to the magical and the supernatural world. And a lot of the mounds that we get in North America seem to have had kind of a sinister purpose. So I mentioned, for example, the Serpent Mound. And a lot of researchers think that that serpent has a direct tie to kind of the serpent that's mentioned in the Genesis 3 story in the Old Testament. And in later centuries, there arises a couple of different kind of darker Gnostic sects, the Apites, the Sethites, who thought that they could use kind of the power of this primordial serpent, harness the power of this primordial serpent for kind of evil ends. We kind of see that with the giant civilizations of North America. So I don't know if they have a supernatural origin themselves, but their civilization, their culture, especially their spiritual practices, were very much steeped in the supernatural and in magic.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder how, you know, all of a sudden, these ancient cultures have a great knowledge of the stars and mathematics and how to build and all of this. And where did this come from? You know, did they have some kind of supernatural connection or you know, some kind of interdimensional connection to these entities? Or was it, you know, aliens coming, giving them this knowledge, or actual fallen angels, you know?
Yeah. You know, Chris, I will say, I think they're tapping into some type of source. Now, whether we call it extraterrestrial or demonic, I don't know. I don't think all aliens are demons, but they're tapping into something, at least, and for the giants of North America, something dark and something sinister that's bigger than themselves, whatever that is. And I'll leave that there. So
yeah, I definitely have to agree with that one. Now, when we're looking at the whole spectrum of kind of ancient beings that don't fit the description of regular humans, on the other side of the spectrum, we've got, you know, very little people as well from our ancient past, and evidence of that. But those people there's evidence that they could have been highly advanced as well, right?
Yes. So the little people, the brown little people of, you know, of Britain, of ancient Britain, come to mind. And yes, so the Romans have in their accounts meeting these little people, they're not, you know, primitives or savages. They kind of have a very sophisticated civilization of their own, but it's not a Roman civilization. So the Romans, as they do with any other civilization they find, they try to make it assimilate to Rome or they destroy it. So, but yes, so not just giants, but also small beings as well. I haven't done as much. I'm really big into giants, always have been. Maybe it's because I'm such a short person myself. I haven't done as much research into the little people of the old world, but that's something I'd like to look at some more.
Now you mentioned the possibility of possibly these giants having maybe a breakaway civilization that went into the center of the earth, or, you know, maybe they were advanced. Do you think it's possible that they had enough advanced technology to make it off planet to the stars?
Yes, absolutely. So if you look at going to South America, I've talked a lot about the Northern Hemisphere, but if you look at South America, with the Mayans, and I think this is where Von Däniken and others like him have hit the nail directly on the head. You know, you look at some of those reliefs, those are rocket ships, Chris. Those are rocket ships, and they are flying to outer space. And I absolutely believe, my friend Cliff Dunning's talked about this a little bit more, but I actually absolutely believe that they got off planet to perhaps the moon and maybe perhaps to even Mars. And you'll see a lot of similarities with what people have argued, I think correctly, pyramids on Mars, with the pyramids that you get in Egypt, the pyramids that you get in South America, and the dimensions that you find with the North American mounds. So yes, I think it's very possible that they did.
And, you know, that being said, it could be possible that the UFO phenomenon, the extraterrestrial phenomenon, could be us from an ancient civilization that escaped and is coming back to check on us, you know?
I definitely think that's one possibility. I think that disclosure over time, I think, is going to kind of reveal that. And I think that's the thing that may be shocking to a lot of people, and that the governments of the world kind of want to hold back, that the UFOs are ourselves. Excuse me.
Now, this topic is not one that mainstream academia will touch with a 10-foot pole usually. Yeah. Now, being in this field and also being, you know, a professor and teacher, have you had any pushback from mainstream academia for looking into this?
Yeah, it's interesting because as a college teacher, I don't actually talk about a lot of this stuff in my classes. I teach an Old Testament, introductory Old Testament class, and I'll bring in giants as characters within, you know, the story of Noah, for example. Or how, you know, the story of Noah has traditionally been interpreted. But if I was on tenure track, for example, a lot of what I'm saying would likely be used against me to make sure that I didn't get tenure. Though I do see a very slow shift. Mainstream academia is not going to say something like giants once existed and had civilization on the earth. But I do see a slow shift where mainstream academia is starting to acknowledge that things that they thought didn't exist, such as whole-scale cities the size of London and New York in South America or North America, once existed. And that's a big deal. Mainstream academia has always been all right with, you know, South American civilization, the Mayans, the Aztecs. We see that with their pyramids. But for them to say something similar about North America is kind of a big, though, what's the word I'm looking for? Big and subtle shift at the same time. They've acknowledged it, but they haven't been too vocal about acknowledging it. But I think you're starting to see a shift where there's trying to be a readjustment of what North American history was, what American history, ancient American history was.
Now, what about the fields of archaeology? I just went to see Graham Hancock yesterday, well, this weekend at his mystery store. A magical mystery tour here at Gaia near Boulder, and it was extraordinary. Wow. But he was talking about how, modern-day archaeologists, they have their own view of something, and if that is threatened, they will do anything to fight that alternative perspective, and gets very ugly in that field. What do you think that maybe one day the field of archaeology may come around to some of this stuff?
I think that slowly, and I even think the Smithsonian is trying to redeem kind of the narrative that it has presented about ancient America being just a completely unsophisticated, uncivilized place. I think it's slowly trying to change that. The problem with archaeology, I mentioned this before, is that archaeology, biblical studies is exactly the same way. It's so steeped in these different schools of thought. So people coming into the into the field of archaeology, they never really are able to say what's on their mind. They're only able to say what archaeologists before them said and re-express that, give a reboot to these earlier ideas. So you're basically stuck within a particular school of thought from the early 20th century, and it's very hard to get out of that and to express something radical or new. I think Egyptology is a great example of this, where it really hasn't made any radical headway within the last 50 years. People are just regurgitating and restating what others have said before. This was Schock's problem with Egyptology, for example.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the Old Testament. But first, before we talk about mainly some of the characters and a couple of stories from the Old Testament, before we get to that, when it comes to the gods or the gods of Egypt, whenever you hear the term the gods, do you think that these were physical men, supernatural entities, or astrological kind of symbology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for myself, as a person of faith, I think that it's a supernatural being. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Von Däniken says something that's really interesting. So Von Däniken says, he's a religious person like myself. He believes in God with a capital G. But he acknowledges that, especially in the Old Testament, a lot of the stories that you get seem to have be talking about gods with a lowercase g. Mm-hmm. And are, especially with, Ezekiel and Daniel and some of these later prophetic stories, possibly extraterrestrial encounters. And so in the ancient world, if you see a freaking flying saucer flying in the sky, you're not going to call it a UFO, an unidentified flying object carrying extraterrestrials from the Pleiades sector. You're going to call it Elohim. You're going to call them Ha Elohim, the gods. So, and Stitchin mentions this as well. So the Anunnaki, the term Elim, Elohim, the plural terms for gods, these are all likely references to extraterrestrial phenomena. And then some of that I do think is supernatural phenomena, but others clearly just extraterrestrial phenomenon. Also possibly, we get this in the Old Testament, where you'll have a very, very mighty figure, perhaps a giant, who takes over a particular country, particular nation, creates an empire. And when that giant or that great person dies, they are deified to the status of a god. The best example of this is the Canaanite god El. El, for biblical scholars will tell you this, El was likely a Canaanite king, a very powerful Canaanite king. In my estimate, if you read the ancient Near Eastern text, he was a giant of some type. He dies, and so his name becomes the name for God, and people start to worship him, El Shaddai, El Elyon. But this was likely a human being who was later worshipped as a god. So I think it's all three. I think extraterrestrial encounters, deified human beings, and supernatural beings.
Very good. Great explanation. Now, I want to go back to some of the characters in the Bible and some of the stories. First, let's talk about your take on Moses and just the aspects of, you know, do you think that he may have had some supernatural connections, some kind of spiritual types of powers that, you know, normal people didn't?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting with Moses, and I always mention this. I mention this in the Old Testament class I teach. Moses is not really anything without this staff that he holds. Him and Aaron have this staff, and they're able to do all this awesome, cool stuff with this staff. So the question here is not, I think you raised a really good point, not what's going on with Moses. What's going on with the staff that Moses is holding? What the heck is that thing? So I think that whatever Moses got his hand on is some type of possible supernatural or extraterrestrial device or object that he can use to manipulate things and do all of these really cool things. And it's interesting that before Moses goes before Pharaoh and does all this really cool stuff with the staff, where does he get the staff from? Well, he gets the staff from when he goes up to see God on Mount Sinai at the beginning of Exodus chapter 3. And when he does that, it says that God appeared to him in the flaming bush, and that the angel of the Lord, Malach Adonai, appeared to him in the flaming bush. This is weird if this is a supernatural encounter. So what is going on here? And one possible way that I would read this is that this is an extraterrestrial encounter. He's seeing a flaming ball, how UFOs are often described. So a ship of light with somebody inside of it, which the biblical author identifies as a malach, as an angel. So I'm thinking that, you know, this is some type of extraterrestrial object that he's given straight from the spaceship when he's talking to the being that he identifies as God.
That's really cool. And you know, some of the explanations for what the ancients saw in the sky based on biblical text, it would make so much sense if it was some sort of UFO or extraterrestrial encounter. That's really interesting. Now, I want to get your take on the story of Noah and the flood. What do you think that he actually, you know, gathered this amount of animals on a ark to save humanity?
Yeah, well, this is, you know, the guy from Ancient Aliens, I always mispronounce his name, Giorgio.
I'm not the last name either.
I don't mess up.
Yeah,
his name.
Right.
So, anyway, he gave a theory about the ark a couple years ago, saying that it wasn't really this boat. So. I laugh at the Noah's Ark story because a couple of years ago, for a church conference, I was down in Kentucky, and there's a theme park in Kentucky that has a full replica of Noah's Ark, and it's this big ship that's in this water, and it's really cool to see. You can see it from like miles away, and then when you go inside, it's kind of cool as well. But the biblical text, if you read the Hebrew and what's been translated into the Greek and the Latin, it's not really a boat per se. The Latin has the term arca, which means a chest or a box of some type. And the dimensions that are given the dimensions are kind of vague as to the ark. So other things in the Bible, the dimensions are very, very specific. So like the dimensions of the tabernacle, dimensions of the temple, dimensions of the ark are vague. So what this suggests is that we're dealing with something that could have been much, much bigger than what we traditionally get in pop culture tellings of the story of Noah's ark. So not just a boat, not a boat per se, mm-hmm. but like a big, like I would say like a storehouse, warehouse type of vessel. Mm-hmm. And this isn't even a vessel that floats on the ground. There's an interesting thing in the Hebrew, and the Latin does the same thing. It says that when the flood waters came, the ark was lifted up al mayim in the Hebrew and supra aquam in the Latin, above the water, on top of the water, over the water. So in my mind, that is a type of vessel that is hovering, not floating in the water, but hovering above the water. So like I would say even something that's kind of like a best term I can use, Chris, is like a spaceship or a flying ship of some kind that is super enormous and hovering over the water. So evidence here, I've always taken it like this, it's some type of advanced technology that's in play here that Noah is using here. But in any case, something big enough to hold all the animals, something miles and miles and miles long, able to hold all the animals, and something powerful enough to be propelled, to have a propulsion system that takes it high enough above where the flood is occurring.
And to think how they portray these ancients in movies, you know, just long robes and sticks and, you know, primitive tools and things of that nature when, this could have like been that. Like Star Wars, you know?
Yes, yeah. I think a lot of cases it was like that.
What are some of the most profound, I guess, biblical stories that could be related maybe to extraterrestrials or something way more fantastical than we could have ever imagined?
Yeah, so a lot of people point out Ezekiel's vision of the wheel within the wheel, which seems to be a straight-up UFO encounter. But we have some other interesting encounters, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. We have Elijah's chariot. Elijah is one of the Old Testament prophets. It's interesting because in the story, he knows that a chariot is going to take him up into the sky. Everybody knows it. He's like, you know, his apprentice, Elisha, knows it. And then all of a sudden this chariot comes. So that suggests to me that this isn't just a standard alien abduction. These people communicated, whoever these, what they consider to be gods, they knew about, they communicated with, they contacted them. And whatever they're calling chariots, they would call chariots anything that flew in the air. So that term chariot really, I think, is synonymous with your flying saucer or your alien spaceship. So that's always an amazing one. You have some really interesting stuff in the New Testament with, for example, the Star of Bethlehem. So a star that comes and hovers directly over a house. Stars don't do that. So what was that star really? Well, go figure. And then in the writings of Paul, for example, you have Paul talking about being taken up to the second and third heaven and seeing unspeakable things. Is that an alien abduction? Is that a UFO abduction? Sounds a lot like it. So very interesting.
That is very interesting. Now, to close out, I want to get your thoughts. Now, I know you specialize mainly in Old Testament. You mentioned the New Testament just now. What are your thoughts on Jesus and who or what he was?
Yeah. Well, I mean, from a religious perspective, you know, Jesus is my Lord and Savior. But there's some interesting things. We have this motif we get with the Jesus birth narrative, not just with him, but with John the Baptist and in the Old Testament about women who shouldn't become pregnant because they are virgins or they are very old, but who do become pregnant. And this goes all the way back to what you mentioned before with Noah and Enoch and those traditions where these women seem to become pregnant by either supernatural or extraterrestrial means. That's very interesting there with Jesus. One of the most profound things for me, Chris, And I say this as a religious person, is that Jesus in the Gospel of John is always saying that he's not of this world and that he has to get back to the world of the Father, which always reminded me of like E.T. In fact, I learned later on that Spielberg was inspired by the story of Jesus to do E.T. But very interesting there. Jesus seems to, you know, state that he's from a specific world, a specific planet. And in Mormon scriptures, this actually, there's much more detail. It talks about Jesus creating many, many planets, and that Jesus has, you know, there are human beings on all these planets that Jesus loves and that Jesus cares for. So very interesting language there. I've always said that Jesus is very much depicted like an alien in the Gospel of John.
Yeah, the more I learn about the E.T. phenomenon, the more my view has changed. When I first started looking into this stuff years ago, I used to think it was just, you know, mainly a strictly physical phenomenon where, you know, these dudes are coming from Zeta Reticuli or across the galaxy yeah. on these tin cans to visit us. But I know it's so much more than that, and it's connected to supernatural activity. It's connected to other types of phenomenon, and it's a more of an interdimensional. It's also a non-physical, but even though it can be physical, and I think that it's quite obvious that you know, if you're looking at it through the lens of extraterrestrials, why would it be that much more you know, insane for it to be an angel? You know, or a demon. Yeah. I think it's all the same. I think that this phenomenon, it's interwoven in ways that we probably won't understand, at least maybe not in this lifetime. But who knows? We're going a lot further than I thought we were in the past few years when it comes to looking at some of this stuff. But it's a double-edged sword when it comes to the society we're living in. But what do you think? Do you think that, you know, the extraterrestrials or angels, it's all the same kind of paranormal soup mix?
You know, if you look at a Malachim or an Agalos or an angel in the Old or New Testament, they have a lot of characteristics that are very similar to your extraterrestrials. So, yeah, for me, they're synonymous. And I've mentioned that on other podcasts as well. So your Malachim, your Malach, or your angel of the Old Testament is your modern day unidentified UFO. So, yeah.
That's fascinating. Adam, man, thank you for coming on again. Always fun talking to you. Yeah, it's great. Now, before you head out, is there anything that you're currently working on or have upcoming that you'd like to tell the audience about?
Working on a couple of projects. So, writing a second book on giants, focusing on some famous biblical figures who may or may have not been giants, not just Goliath, but some other ones who were lesser known. I've had to put that a little bit on halt since things have been very busy with the teaching, and I'm a student as well at the moment. But I am working on that, working on a couple of Bible commentaries as we're speaking, hopefully to come out sometime next year or in 2023. There's a book that I have that I'm currently in the process of getting published, which is It collects some lectures that I gave on something called the Michigan Relic. So you were talking about evidence for the giants and for advanced ancient civilizations in North America. Well, we have these things called Michigan relics, dismissed by mainstream archaeology as forgeries and hoaxes, but much more complicated than that. And many of them, in fact, seem to be authentic. And they have this really cool, funky thing called the mystic symbol, which is at the top of them, which seems to be a reference to the divine name of God as found in the Old Testament. But we're really not quite sure what the heck that thing is, but very, very interesting.
Man, that is super interesting. Well, I'm going to definitely have to have you back on soon to talk about all that and your new books.
That'd be great.
Awesome, Adam. Well, thank you so much for coming on again. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We will talk again tomorrow.